all day.
It's gonna be a boomer, Parker yelled gleefully.
They were on top of a gradually slanting plateau, and they could see the curtain of rain beating across the woods toward them below the purple thunderheads. Directly above them, the sky had gone a sick yellow. A tornado sky, Garrity thought. Wouldn't that be the living end? What would they do if a tornado just came tearing ass down the road and carried them all off to Oz in a whirling cloud of dirt, flapping shoe leather, and whirling watermelon seeds? He laughed. The wind ripped the laugh out of his mouth.
McFreeze!
McFreeze angled to meet him. He was bent into the wind, his clothes plastered against his body and streaming out behind him. The black hair and the white scar etched against his tan face made him look like a weathered, slightly mad sea captain astride the bridge of his ship.
What?
He bellowed.
Is there a provision in the rules for an act of God?
McVreeze considered.
No, I don't think so.
He began buttoning his jacket.
What happens if we get struck by lightning?
McVreeze threw back his head and cackled.
We'll be dead!
Garrity snorted and walked away. Some of the others were looking up into the sky anxiously. This was going to be no little shower, the kind that had cooled them off after yesterday's heat. What had Parker said? A boomer. Yes, it certainly was going to be a boomer. A baseball cap went cartwheeling between his legs, and Garrity looked over his shoulder and saw a small boy looking after it longingly. Scram grabbed it and tried to scale it back to the kid, but the wind took it in a big boomerang arc, and it wound up in a wildly lashing tree. Thunder whacked. A white-purple tine of lightning jabbed the horizon. The comforting sough of the wind in the pines had become 100 mad ghosts, flapping and hooting. The guns cracked. A small popgun sound almost lost in the thunder and the wind. Garrity jerked his head around, the premonition that Olson had finally bought his bullet strong upon him. But Olson was still there, his flapping clothes revealing how amazingly fast the weight had melted off him. Olson had lost his jacket somewhere. The arms that poked out of his short shirt sleeves were bony and as thin as pencils. It was somebody else who was being dragged off. The face was small and exhausted, and very dead beneath the whipping mane of his hair.
If it was a tailwind, we could be in Old Town by 4:30,
Barkovich said gleefully. He had his rain hat jammed down over his ears, and his sharp face was joyful and demented. Garrity suddenly understood. He reminded himself to tell McVreeze, Barkovich was crazy. A few minutes later, the wind suddenly dropped off. The thunder faded to a series of thick mutters. The heat sucked back at them, clammy and nearly unbearable after the rushy coolness of the wind.
What happened to it?
Collie Parker brayed.
Garrity, does this goddamn state punk out on its rainstorms too?
I think you'll get what you want, Garrity said. I don't know if you'll want it when you get it, though.
Yoo-hoo! Raymond! Raymond Garrity!
Garrity's head jerked up. For one awful moment, he thought it was his mother, and visions of Percy danced through his head. But it was only an elderly, sweet-faced lady peeping at him from beneath a Vogue magazine she was using as a rain hat.
Old bag, Art Baker muttered at his elbow.
She looks sweet enough to me. Do you know her?
I know the type, Baker said balefully. She looks just like my Aunt Hattie. She used to like to go to funerals, listen to the weeping and wailing and carryings on with just that same smile, like a cat that got into the eggs.
She's probably the Major's mother, Garrity said. It was supposed to be funny, but it fell flat. Baker's face was strained and pallid under the fading light in the rushing sky.
My Aunt Hattie had 9 kids. 9, Garrity. She buried 4 of them with just that same look. Her own young. Some folks like to see other folks die. I can't understand that. Can you?
No, Garrity said. Baker was making him uneasy. The thunder had begun to roll its wagons across the sky again. Your Aunt Hattie, is she dead now?
No. Baker looked up at the sky. She's down home, probably out on the front porch in a rocking chair. She can't walk much anymore, just sitting and rocking and listening to the bulletins on the radio, and smiling each time she hears the new figures.
Baker rubbed his elbows with his palms.
You ever see a cat eat its own kittens, Garrity?
Garrity didn't reply. There was an electric tension in the air now, something about the storm poised above them, and something more. Garrity could not fathom it. When he blinked his eyes, he seemed to see the out-of-kilter eyes of Freaky D'Alessio looking back at him from the darkness. Finally, he said to Baker, "Does everybody in your family study up on dying?" Baker smiled pallidly.
"Well, I was turning over the idea of going to mortician school in a few years. Good job. Morticians go on eating even in a depression."
"I always thought I'd get into urinal manufacture," Garrity said. "Get contracts with cinemas and bowling alleys and things. Sure fire. How many urinal factories can there be in the country?"
"I don't think I'd still want to be a mortician," Baker said. "Not that it matters."
A huge flash of lightning tore across the sky. A gargantuan clap of thunder followed. The wind picked up in jerky gusts. Clouds raced across the sky like crazed privateers across an ebony nightmare sea.
"It's coming," Garrity said. "It's coming, Art." "Some people say they don't care," Baker said suddenly. "Something simple. That's all I want when I go, Dawn." That's what they'd tell him, my uncle. "But most of 'em care plenty. That's what he always told me. They say just a pine box will do me fine. But they end up having a big one, with a lead sleeve if they can afford it. Lots of them even write the model number in their wills."
"Why?" Garrity asked.
"Down home, most of them want to be buried in mausoleums, above ground. They don't want to be underground 'cause the water table's so high where I come from. Things rot quick in the damp. But if you're buried above ground, you got the rats to worry about. Big Louisiana bayou rats. Graveyard rats. They'd gnaw through one of them pine boxes and zip flat."
The wind pulled at them with invisible hands. Garrity wished the storm would come on and come. It was like an insane merry-go-round. No matter who you talked to, you came around to this damned subject again.
"Be fucked if I'd do it," Garrity said. "Lay out $1,500 or something just to keep the rats away after I was dead?"
"I don't know," Baker said. His eyes were half-lidded, sleepy. "They go for the soft parts. That's what troubles my mind. I could see him worrying a hole in my own coffin, then making it bigger, finally wriggling through, and going right for my eyes like they was jujubes. They'd eat my eyes, and then I'd be a part of that rat. Ain't that right?"
"I don't know," Garrity said sickly.
"No, thanks. I'll take that coffin with the lead sleeve, every time."
"Although you'd only actually need it the once," Garrity said, with a horrified little giggle.
"That is true," Baker agreed solemnly.
Lightning forked again, an almost pink streak that left the air smelling of ozone. A moment later the storm smote them again, but it wasn't rain this time. It was hail. In a space of 5 seconds, they were being pelted by hailstones the size of small pebbles. Several of the boys cried out, and Garrity shielded his eyes with one hand. The wind rose to a shriek. Hailstones bounced and smashed against the road, against faces and bodies. Jensen ran in a huge, rambling circle, eyes covered, feet stumbling and rebounding against each other in a total panic. He finally blundered off the shoulder, and the soldiers on the half-track pumped half a dozen rounds into the undulating curtain of hail before they could be sure.
"Goodbye, Jensen," Garrity thought. "Sorry, man."
The rain began to fall through the hail, sluicing down the hill they were climbing, melting the hail scattered around their feet. Another wave of stones hit them, more rain, another splatter of hail, and then the rain was falling in steady sheets, punctuated by loud claps of thunder.
"God damn!"
Parker yelled, striding up to Garrity. His face was covered with red blotches, and he looked like a drowned water rat.
"Garrity, this is without a doubt."
"Yeah, the most fucked up state in the 51, Garrity finished. "Go soak your head."
Parker threw his head back, opened his mouth, and let the cold rain patter in.
"I am, goddammit, I am."
Garrity bent himself into the wind and caught up with McVries.
"How does this grab you?" he asked.
McVries clutched himself and shivered.
"You can't win. Now I wish the sun was out."
"It won't last long," Garrity said, but he was wrong. As they walked into 4 o'clock, it was still raining. Chapter 10. There was no sunset as they walked into their second night on the road. The rainstorm gave way to a light, chilling drizzle around 4:30. The drizzle continued on until almost 8 o'clock. Then the clouds began to break up and show bright, coldly flickering stars. Garrity pulled himself closer together inside his damp clothes and did not need a weatherman to know which way the wind blew. Fickle spring had pulled the balmy warmth that had come with them this far from beneath them like an old rug. Maybe the crowds provided some warmth, radiant heat or something. More and more of them lined the road. They were huddled together for warmth, but were undemonstrative. They watched the walkers go past and then went home or hurried on to the next vantage point. If it was blood the crowds were looking for, they hadn't gotten much of it. They had lost only 2 since Jensen, both of them younger boys, who had simply fainted dead away. That put them exactly halfway. No, really more than half. 50 down, 49 to go. Garrity was walking by himself. He was too cold to be sleepy. His lips were pressed together to keep the tremble out of them. Olson was still back there. Half-hearted bets had gone round to the effect that Olson would be the 50th to buy a ticket, the halfway boy. But he hadn't. That signal honor had gone to 13, Roger Fenham. Unlucky old 13. Garrity was beginning to think that Olson would go on indefinitely, maybe until he starved to death. He had locked himself safely away in a place beyond pain. In a way, he supposed it would be poetic justice if Olson won. He could see the headlines, "Long Walk Won by Dead Man." Garrity's toes were numb. He wiggled them against the shredded inner linings of his shoes and could feel nothing. The real pain was not in his toes now. It was in his arches. A sharp, blatting pain that knifed up into his calves each time he took a step. It made him think of a story his mother had read him when he was small. It was about a mermaid who wanted to be a woman. Only she had a tail, and a good fairy or someone said she could have legs if she wanted them badly enough. Every step she took on dry land would be like walking on knives, but she could have them if she wanted them. And she said, "Yeah, okay." And that was the long walk. In a nutshell,
"Warning! Warning, 47!
"I hear you," Garrity snapped crossly, and picked up his feet. The woods were thinner. the real northern part of the state was behind them. They had gone through two quietly residential towns, the road cutting them lengthwise and the sidewalks packed with people that were little more than shadows beneath the drizzle-diffused street lamps. No one cheered much. It was too cold, he supposed. Too cold and too dark, and Jesus Christ, now he had another warning to walk off, and if that wasn't a royal pisser, nothing was. His feet were slowing again, and he forced himself to pick them up. Somewhere quite far up ahead, Barkovich said something and followed it up with a short burst of his unpleasant laughter. He could hear McVries's response clearly.
Shut up, killer.
Barkovich told McVries to go to hell, and now he seemed quite upset by the whole thing. Garrity smiled wanly in the darkness. He had dropped back almost to the tail of the column and reluctantly realized he was angling towards Stebbins again. Something about Stebbins fascinated him, but he decided he didn't particularly care what that something was. It was time to give up wondering about things. There was no percentage in it. It was just another royal pisser. There was a huge luminescent arrow ahead in the dark. It glowed like an evil spirit. Suddenly a brass band struck up a march. A good-sized band by the sound. There were louder cheers. The air was full of drifting fragments, and for a crazy moment, Garrity thought it was snowing. But it wasn't snow. It was confetti. They were changing roads. The old one met the new one at a right angle, and another main turnpike sign announced that Old Town was now a mere 16 miles away. Garrity felt a tentative feeler of excitement, maybe even pride. After Old Town, he knew the route. He could have traced it on the palm of his hand.
Maybe it's your edge. I don't think so, but maybe it is.
Garrity jumped. It was as if Stebbins had pried the lid off his mind and peeked down inside. What?
It's your country, isn't it?
Not up here. I've never been north of Greenbush in my life, except when we drove up to the marker, and we didn't come this way. They left the brass band behind them, its tubas and clarinets glistening softly in the moist night.
But we go through your hometown, don't we?
No, but close by it.
Stebbins grunted.
Garrity looked down at Stebbins's feet and saw with surprise that Stebbins had removed his tennis shoes and was wearing a pair of soft-looking moccasins. His shoes were tucked into a chambray shirt.
I'm saving the tennis shoes, Stebbins said, just in case. But I think the mocks will finish it.
Oh.
They passed a radio tower standing skeletal in an empty field. A red light pulsed as regular as a heartbeat at its tip.
Looking forward to seeing your loved ones?
Yes, I am, Garrity said.
What happens after that?
Happens? Garrity shrugged. Keep on walking down the road, I guess.
Unless you are all considerate enough to buy out by then.
Oh. I don't think so, Stebbins said, smiling remotely.
Are you sure you won't be walked out after you see them?
Man, I'm not sure of anything, Garrity said. I didn't know much when I started, and I know less now.
You think you have a chance?
I don't know that either. I don't even know why I bother talking to you. It's like talking to smoke. Far ahead, police sirens howled and gobbled in the night.
Somebody broke through the road up ahead where the police are spread thinner, Stebbins said.
The natives are getting restless, Garrity. Just think of all the people diligently making way for you up ahead.
For you too.
Me too,
Stebbins agreed, then didn't say anything for a long time. The collar of his chambray work shirt flapped vacuously against his neck.
It's amazing how the mind operates the body, he said at last. It's amazing how it can take over and dictate to the body. Your average housewife may walk up to 16 miles a day,
from icebox to ironing board to clothesline. She's ready to put her feet up at the end of the day, but she's not exhausted. A door-to-door salesman might do 20. A high school kid in training for football walks 25 to 28. That's in one day from getting up in the morning to going to bed at night. All of them get tired, but none of them get exhausted.
Yeah.
But suppose you told the housewife, today you must walk 16 miles before you can have your supper.
Garrity nodded. She'd be exhausted instead of tired.
Stebbins said nothing. Garrity had the perverse feeling that Stebbins was disappointed in him.
Well, wouldn't she?
Don't you think she'd have her 16 miles in by noon so she could kick off her shoes and spend the afternoon watching the soaps?
I do.
Are you tired, Garrity?
Yeah, Garrity said shortly. I'm tired.
Exhausted?
Well, I'm getting there.
No, you're not getting exhausted yet, Garrity.
He jerked a thumb at Olson's silhouette.
That's exhausted. He's almost through now.
Garrity watched Olson, fascinated, almost expecting him to drop at Stebbins's word.
What are you driving at?
Ask your cracker friend Art Baker. A mule doesn't like to plow, but he likes carrots. So you hang a carrot in front of his eyes. A mule without a carrot gets exhausted. A mule with a carrot spends a long time being tired. You get it?
No.
Stebbins smiled again.
You will.
Watch Olson. He's lost his appetite for the carrot. He doesn't quite know it yet, but he has. Watch Olson, Garrity. You can learn from Olson.
Garrity looked at Stebbins closely, not sure how seriously to take him.
Stebbins laughed aloud. His laugh was rich and full, a startling sound that made other walkers turn their heads.
Go on. Go talk to him, Garrity. And if you won't talk, just get up close and have a good look. It's never too late to learn.
Garrity swallowed.
Is it a very important lesson, would you say?
Stebbins stopped laughing. He caught Garrity's wrist in a strong grip.
The most important lesson you'll ever learn, maybe. The secret of life over death. Reduce that equation and you can afford to die, Garrity. You can spend your life like a drunkard on a spree.
Stebbins dropped his hand. Garrity massaged his wrist slowly. Stebbins seemed to have dismissed him again. Nervously, Garrity walked away from him and toward Olson. It seemed to Garrity that he was drawn toward Olson on an invisible wire. He flanked him at 4 o'clock. He tried to fathom Olson's face. Once, a long time ago, he had been frightened into a long night of wakefulness by a movie starring... who? It had been Robert Mitchum, hadn't it? He had been playing the role of an implacable Southern Revival minister who had also been a compulsive murderer. In silhouette, Olson looked a little bit like him now. His form had seemed to elongate as the weight sloughed off him. His skin had gone scaly with dehydration. His eyes had sunk into hollowed sockets. His hair flew aimlessly on his skull like wind-driven corn silk. Why, he's nothing but a robot. Nothing but an automation, really. Can there still be an Olson in there hiding? No, he's gone. I am quite sure that the Olson who sat on the grass and joked and told about the kid who froze on the starting line and bought his ticket right there, that Olson is gone. This is a dead clay thing.
Olson? He whispered.
Olson walked on. He was a shambling, haunted house on legs. Olson had fouled himself. Olson smelled bad.
Olson, can you talk? Olson swept onward. His face was turned into the darkness, and he was moving. Yes, he was moving. Something was going on here. Something was still ticking over, but... something. Yes, there was something. But what?
They breasted another rise. The breath came shorter and shorter in Garrity's lungs until he was panting like a dog. Tiny vapors of steam rose from his wet clothes. There was a river below them, lying in the dark like a silver snake. The Stillwater, he imagined. The Stillwater passed near Old Town. A few half-hearted cheers went up, but not many. Further on, nestled against the far side of the river's dogleg, maybe it was the Penobscot after all, was a nestle of lights. Old Town. A smaller nestle of light on the other side would be Milford and Bradley. Old Town. They had made it to Old Town. Olson, he said. That's Old Town. Those lights are Old Town. We're getting there, fellow. Olson made no answer, and now he could remember what had been eluding him, and it was nothing so vital after all. Just that Olson reminded him of the Flying Dutchman, sailing on and on after the whole crew had disappeared. They walked rapidly down a long hill, passed through an S-curve, and crossed a bridge that spanned, according to the sign, Meadowbrook. On the far side of the bridge was another steep hill, trucks use low gear sign. There were groans from some of the walkers. It was indeed a steep hill. It seemed to rise above them like a toboggan slide. It was not long. Even in the dark, they could see the summit. But it was steep, all right. Plenty steep. They started up. Garrity leaned into the slope, feeling his grip on his respiration start to trickle away almost at once. Be panting like a dog at the top, he thought, and then thought, if I get to the top. There was a protesting clamor rising in both legs. It started in his thighs and worked its way down. His legs were screaming at him that they simply weren't going to do this shit any longer. But you will, Garrity told them. You will or you'll die. I don't care, his legs answered back. Don't care if I do die, do die, do die. The muscles seemed to be softening, melting like jello left out in a hot sun. They trembled almost helplessly. They twitched like badly controlled puppets. Warnings cracked out right and left, and Garrity realized he would be getting one for his very own soon enough. He kept his eyes fixed on Olson, forcing himself to match his pace to Olson's. They would make it together, up over the top of this killer hill, and then he would get Olson to tell him his secret. Then everything would be Jake, and he wouldn't have to worry about Stebbins or McVries or Jan or his father. No, not even about Freaky D'Alessio, who had spread his head on a stone wall beside US-1 like a dollop of glue. What was it? 100 feet on? 50? What? Now he was panting. The first gunshots rang out. There was a loud yipping scream that was drowned by more gunshots. And at the brow of the hill, they got one more. Garrity could see nothing in the dark. His tortured pulse hammered in his temples. He found that he didn't give a fuck who had bought it this time. It didn't matter. Only the pain mattered. The tearing pain in his legs and lungs. The hill rounded, flattened, and rounded still more on the downslope. The far side was gently sloping, perfect for regaining wind. But that soft jelly filling in his muscles didn't want to leave. My legs are going to collapse, Garrity thought calmly. They'll never take me as far as Freeport. I don't think I can make it to Old Town. I'm dying, I think. A sound began to beat its way into the night then, savage and orgiastic. It was a voice.
It was many voices, and it was repeating the same thing over and over.
Garrity! 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 Garrity!
It was God or his father, about to cut the legs out from under him before he could learn the secret. The secret. The secret of... like thunder.
Garrity! Garrity! Garrity!
It wasn't his father, and it wasn't God. It was what appeared to be the entire student body of Old Town High School chanting his name in unison. As they caught sight of his white, weary, and strained face, the steady beating cry dissolved into wild cheering. Cheerleaders fluttered pom-poms. Boys whistled shrilly and kissed their girls. Garrity waved back, smiled, nodded, and craftily crept closer to Olson.
Olson, he whispered. Olson.
Olson's eyes might have flickered a tiny bit. A spark of life like the single turn of an old starter in a junked automobile.
Tell me how, Olson, he whispered. Tell me what to do.
The high school girls and boys. Did I once go to high school? Garrity wondered. Was that a dream? Were behind them now, still cheering rapturously. Olson's eyes moved jerkily in their sockets, as if long rusted and in need of oil. His mouth fell open with a nearly audible clunk.
That's it, Garrity whispered eagerly. Talk. Talk to me, Olson. Tell me. Tell me.
Olson said. Garrity moved even closer. He put a hand on Olson's shoulder and leaned into an evil nimbus of sweat, halitosis, and urine.
Please, Garrity said. Try hard.
God. God's garden.
God's garden? Garrity repeated doubtfully. What about God's garden, Olson?
It's full of weeds,
Olson said sadly. His head bounced against his chest. Garrity said nothing. He could not. They were going up another hill now, and he was panting again. Olson did not seem to be out of breath at all.
I don't want to die,
Olson finished. Garrity's eyes were soldered to the shadowed ruin that was Olson's face. Olson turned creakily toward him. Olson raised his lolling head slowly.
Garrity?
Yes, it's me.
What time is it?
Garrity had rewound and reset his watch earlier. God knew why. It's 9:15.
No. No later than that.
Mild surprise washed over Olson's shattered old man's face.
Olson!
He shook Olson's shoulder gently, and Olson's whole frame seemed to tremble, like a gantry in a high wind.
What's it all about?
Suddenly Garrity cackled madly.
What's it all about, Alfie?
Olson looked at Garrity with calculated shrewdness.
Garrity,
he whispered. His breath was like a sewer draft.
What?
What time is it?
Damn it!
Garrity shouted at him. He turned his head quickly, but Stebbins was staring down at the road. If he was laughing at Garrity, it was too dark to see.
Garrity?
What? Garrity said more quietly.
Jesus will save you.
Olson's head came up all the way. He began to walk off the road. He was walking at the half track.
Warning. Warning, 70.
Olson never slowed. There was a ruinous dignity about him. The gabble of the crowd quieted. They watched wide-eyed. Olson never hesitated. He reached the soft shoulder. He put his hands over the side of the half-track. He began to clamber painfully up the side.
Olson!
Abraham yelled, startled.
Hey, that's Hank Olson!
The soldiers brought their guns around in perfect four-part harmony. Olson grabbed the barrel of the closest and yanked it out of the hands that held it as if it had been an ice cream stick. It clattered off into the crowd. They shrank from it, screaming, as if it had been a live adder. Then one of the other three guns went off. Garrity saw the flash at the end of the barrel quite clearly. He saw the jerky ripple of Olson's shirt as the bullet entered his belly and then punched out the back. Olson did not stop. He gained the top of the half-track and grabbed the barrel of the gun that had just shot him. He levered it up into the air as it went off again.
Get him!
McVries was screaming savagely up ahead.
Get him, Olson! Kill him! Kill him!
The other two guns roared in unison, and the impact of the heavy-caliber slugs sent Olson flying off the half-track. He landed spread-eagled on his back, like a man nailed to a cross. One side of his belly was a black and shredded ruin. Three more bullets were pumped into him. The guard Olson had disarmed had produced another carbine, effortlessly, from inside the half-track. Olson sat up. He put his hands against his belly and stared calmly at the poised soldiers on the deck of the squat vehicle. The soldiers stared back.
You bastards,
McVries sobbed.
You bloody bastards.
Olson began to get up. Another volley of bullets drove him flat again. Now there was a sound from behind Garrity. He didn't have to turn his head to know it was Stebbins. Stebbins was laughing softly. Olson sat up again. The guns were still trained on him, but the soldiers did not shoot. Their silhouettes on the half-track seemed almost to indicate curiosity. Slowly, reflectively, Olson gained his feet, hands crossed on his belly. He seemed to sniff the air for direction, turned slowly in the direction of the walk, and began to stagger along.
Put him out of it!
A shocked voice screamed hoarsely.
For Christ's sake, put him out of it!
The blue snakes of Olson's intestines were slowly slipping through his fingers. They dropped like link sausages against his groin, where they flapped obscenely. He stopped, bent over as if to retrieve them.
Retrieve them,
Garrity thought, in a near ecstasy of wonder and horror, and threw up a huge glut of blood and bile. He began to walk again, bent over. His face was sweetly calm.
Oh, my God,
Abraham said, and turned to Garrity with his hands cupped over his mouth. Abraham's face was white and cheesy. His eyes were bulging. His eyes were frantic with terror.
Oh, my God, Ray. What a fucking gross out. Oh, Jesus.
Abraham vomited. Puke sprayed through his fingers. Well, old Abe has tossed his cookies, Garrity thought remotely. That's no way to observe Hint 13, Abe.
They gut shot him, Stebbins said from behind Garrity. They'll do that. It's deliberate. To discourage anybody else from trying the old charge of the light brigade number.
Get away from me, Garrity hissed, or I'll knock your block off.
Stebbins dropped back quickly.
Warning! Warning, 88!
Stebbins' laugh drifted softly to him. Olson went to his knees. His head hung between his arms, which were propped on the road. One of the rifles roared, and a bullet clipped asphalt beside Olson's left hand and whined away. He began to climb slowly, wearily, to his feet again. They're playing with him, Garrity thought. All of this must be terribly boring for them, so they are playing with Olson. Is Olson fun, boys? Is Olson keeping you amused? Garrity began to cry. He ran over to Olson and fell on his knees beside him and held the tired, hectically hot face against his chest. He sobbed into the dry, bad-smelling hair.
Warning! Warning, 47! Warning! Warning, 61!
McVries was pulling at him. It was McVries again.
Get up, Ray, get up! You can't help him! For God's sake, get up!
It's not fair!
Garrity wept. There was a sticky smear of Olson's blood on his cheekbone.
It's just not fair!
I know. Come on, come on!
Garrity stood up. He and McVries began walking backward rapidly, watching Olson, who was on his knees. Olson got to his feet. He stood astride the white line. He raised both hands up into the sky. The crowd sighed softly.
I did it wrong!
Olson shouted tremblingly, and then fell flat and dead. The soldiers on the half-track put another two bullets in him and then dragged him busily off the road.
Yes, that's that.
They walked quietly for 10 minutes or so, Garrity drawing a low-key comfort just from McVries's presence.
I'm starting to see something in it, Pete, he said at last. There's a pattern. It isn't all senseless.
Yeah? Don't count on it.
He talked to me, Pete. He wasn't dead until they shot him. He was alive.
Now it seemed that was the most important thing about the Olson experience. He repeated it.
Alive.
I don't think it makes any difference, McVries said with a tired sigh.
He's just a number, part of the body count, number 53. It means we're a little closer, and that's all it means.
You don't really think that?
Don't tell me what I think and what I don't, McVries said crossly. Leave it alone, can't you?
I put us about 13 miles outside of Old Town, Garrity said.
Well, hot shit!
Do you know how Scram is?
I'm not his doctor, why don't you Scram yourself?
What the hell's eating you?
McVries laughed wildly.
Here we are, and you want to know what's eating me? I'm worried about next year's income taxes, that's what's eating me. I'm worried about the price of grain in South Dakota, that's what's eating me. Olson, his guts were falling out, Garrity. At the end he was walking with his guts falling out. And that's eating me. That's eating me.
He broke off, and Garrity watched him struggle to keep from vomiting. Abruptly, McVries said,
Scram's poor.
Is he?
Collie Parker felt his forehead and said he was burning up. He's talking funny. About his wife, about Phoenix, Flagstaff, weird stuff about the Hopis and the Navajos and Kachina dolls. It's hard to make out.
How much longer can he go?
Who can say? He still might outlast us all. He's built like a buffalo, and he's trying awful hard. Jesus, am I tired.
What about Barkovich?
He's wising up. He knows a lot of us will be glad to see him buy a ticket to see the farm. He's made up his mind to outlast me, the nasty little fucker. He doesn't like me nagging him. Tough shit, right? I know.
McVries uttered his wild laugh again. Garrity didn't like the sound of it.
He's scared, though. He's easing up on the lung power and going to leg power.
We all are.
Yeah. Old Town coming up. 13 miles?
That's right.
Can I say something to you, Garrity?
Sure. I'll carry it with me to the grave.
I suppose that's true.
Someone near the front of the crowd set off a firecracker, and both Garrity and McVries jumped. Several women screeched. A burly man in the front row said, "God damn it!" through a mouthful of popcorn.
"The reason all of this is so horrible," McVries said, "is because it's just trivial, you know? We've sold ourselves and traded our souls on trivialities. Olson, he was trivial. He was magnificent, too, but those things aren't mutually exclusive. He was magnificent and trivial. Either way, or both, he died like a bug under a microscope."
"You're as bad as Stebbins," Garrity said resentfully.
"I wish Priscilla had killed me," McVries said. "At least that would have been trivial," Garrity finished.
"Yes. I think, look, I want to doze a little if I can. You mind?"
"No, I'm sorry."
McVries sounded stiff and offended.
"I'm sorry," Garrity said.
"Look, don't take it to heart. It's really trivial," McVries finished.
He laughed his wild laugh for the third time and walked away.
Garrity wished, not for the first time, that he had made no friends on the long walk. It was going to make it hard. In fact, it was already hard. There was a sluggish stirring in his bowels. Soon they would have to be emptied. The thought made him grind his mental teeth. People would point and laugh. He would drop his shit in the street like a mongrel hound, and afterward, people would gather it up in paper napkins and put it in bottles for souvenirs. It seemed impossible that people would do such things, but he knew it happened. Olson with his guts falling out. McVries and Priscilla and the pajama factory. Scram, glowing fever bright. Abraham. What price stovepipe hat, audience? Garrity's head dropped. He dozed. The walk went on. Over hill, over dale, over stile and mountain, over ridge and under bridge and past my lady's fountain. Garrity giggled in the dimming recesses of his brain. His feet pounded the pavement, and the loose heel flapped looser, like an old shutter on a dead house. "I think, therefore I am." First year Latin class. Old tunes in a dead language. "Ding dong bell, pussy's down the well. Who pushed her in? Little Jackie Flynn." "I exist, therefore I am." Another firecracker went off. There were whoops and cheers. The half-track ground and clattered, and Garrity listened for the sound of his number in a warning and dozed deeper. "Daddy, I wasn't glad when you had to go, but I never really missed you when you were gone. Sorry. But that's not the reason I'm here. I have no subconscious urge to kill myself. Sorry, Stebbins. So sorry, but..." The guns again, startling him awake. And there was the familiar mail sack thud of another boy going home to Jesus. The crowd screamed its horror and roared its approval.
"Garrity!"
a woman squealed.
"Ray Garrity!"
Her voice was harsh and scabbed.
"We're with you, boy! We're with you, Ray!"
Her voice cut through the crowd, and heads turned, necks craned, so that they could get a better look at Maine's own. There were scattered boos, drowned in a rising cheer. The crowd took up the chant again. Garrity heard his name until it was reduced to a jumble of nonsense syllables that had nothing to do with him. He waved briefly and dozed again. Chapter 11. They passed into Old Town around midnight. They switched through two feeder roads, joined Route 2, and went through the center of town. For Ray Garrity, the entire passage was a blurred, sleep-hazed nightmare. The cheering rose and swelled until it seemed to cut off any possibility of thought or reason. Night was turned into glaring, shadowless day by flaring arc sodium lamps that threw a strange orange light. In such a light, even the most friendly face looked like something from a crypt. Confetti, newspaper, shredded pieces of telephone book, and long streamers of toilet paper floated and soared from second and third story windows. It was a New York ticker tape parade in Bush League, USA. No one died in Old Town. The orange arc lamps faded, and the crowd depleted a little as they walked along the Stillwater River in the trench of mourning. It was May 3rd now. The ripe smell of paper mill smote them. A juicy smell of chemicals, wood smoke, polluted river, and stomach cancer waiting to happen. There were conical piles of sawdust higher than the buildings downtown. Heaped stacks of pulpwood stood to the sky like monoliths. Garrity dozed and dreamed his shadowy dreams of relief and redemption, and after what seemed to be an eternity, someone began jabbing him in the ribs. It was McVries.
"What's the matter?"
"We're going on the turnpike," McVries said. He was excited. "The word's back. They got a whole son of a bitch in color guard on the entrance ramp. We're gonna get a 400-gun salute." "Into the Valley of Death rode the 400, Garrity muttered, rubbing the sleepy seeds out of his eyes. "I've heard too many 3-gun salutes tonight. Not interested. Let me sleep."
"That isn't the point. After they get done, we're gonna give them a salute."
"We are?"
"Yeah, a 46-man raspberry."
Garrity grinned a little. It felt stiff and uncertain on his lips.
"That right?"
"It certainly is. Well, a 40-man raspberry. A few of the guys are pretty far gone now." Garrity had a brief vision of Olson, the human Flying Dutchman.
"Well, count me in," he said.
"Bunch up with us a little then." Garrity picked it up. He and McVries moved in tighter with Pearson, Abraham, Baker, and Scram. The leather boys had further shortened their vanguard.
"Barkovich in on it?" Garrity asked.
McVries snorted.
"He thinks it's the greatest idea since pay toilets."
Garrity clutched his cold body a little tighter to himself and let out a humorless little giggle.
"I bet he's got a hell of a wicked raspberry."
They were paralleling the turnpike now. Garrity could see the steep embankment to his right and the fuzzy glow of more arc sodiums, bone white this time, above. A distance ahead, perhaps half a mile, the entrance ramp split off and climbed.
"Here we come," McVries said.
"Kathy!"
Scram yelled suddenly, making Garrity start.
"I ain't gave up yet, Kathy."
He turned his blank, fever-glittering eyes on Garrity. There was no recognition in them. His cheeks were flushed, his lips cracked with fever blisters.
"He ain't so good," Baker said apologetically, as if he had caused it. "We've been giving him water every now and again, also sort of pouring it over his head. But his canteen's almost empty, and if he wants another one, he'll have to holler for it for himself. It's the rules."
"Scram," Garrity said.
"Who's that?"
Scram's eyes rolled wildly in their sockets.
"Me, Garrity."
"Oh, you seen Kathy?"
No, Garrity said uncomfortably.
Here we come, McVries said. The crowd's cheers rose in volume again, and a ghostly green sign came out of the darkness. Interstate 95, Augusta, Portland, Portsmouth, points south.
"That's us,"
Abraham whispered.
"God help us and points south."
The exit ramp tilted up under their feet. They passed into the first splash of light from the overhead arcs. The new paving was smoother beneath their feet, and Garrity felt a familiar lift drop of excitement. The soldiers of the color guard had displaced the crowd along the upward spiral of the ramp. They silently held their rifles to high port. Their dress uniforms gleamed resplendently. Their own soldiers in their dusty half-track looked shabby by comparison. It was like rising above a huge and restless sea of noise and into the calm air. The only sound was their footfalls and the hurried pace of their breathing. The entrance ramp seemed to go on forever, and always the way was fringed by soldiers in scarlet uniforms, their arms held in high-port salute. And then, from the darkness somewhere, came the major's electronically amplified voice.
"Preset arms!"
Weapons slapped flesh.
"Salute ready!"
Guns to shoulders, pointed skyward above them in a steely arch. Everyone instinctively huddled together against the crash, which meant death. It had been Pavlov'd into them.
"Fire!"
400 guns in the night. Stupendous, ear-shattering. Garrity fought down the urge to put his hands to his head.
"Fire!"
Again the smell of powder smoke, acrid, heavy with cordite. In what book did they fire guns over the water to bring the body of a drowned man to the surface?
"My head," Scram moaned. "Oh, Jesus, my head aches."
"Fire!"
The guns exploded for the third and last time. McVries immediately turned around and walked backward, his face going a spotty red with the effort it cost him to shout,
"Present arms!"
40 tongues pursed 40 sets of lips.
"Salute ready!"
Garrity drew breath into his lungs and fought to hold it.
"Fire!"
It was pitiful, really. A pitiful little noise of defiance in the big dark. It was not repeated. The wooden faces of their color guard did not change, but seemed all the same to indicate a subtle reproach.
"Oh, screw it," said McVries.
He turned around and began to walk frontwards again, with his head down. The pavement leveled off. They were on the turnpike. There was a brief vision of the major's jeep spurting away to the south, a flicker of cold fluorescent light against black sunglasses, and then the crowd closed in again. But farther from them now, for the highway was 4 lanes wide, 5 if you counted the grassy median strip. Garrity angled to the median quickly and walked in the close-cropped grass, feeling the dew seep through his cracked shoes and paint his ankles. Someone was warned. The turnpike stretched ahead, flat and monotonous. Stretches of concrete tubing divided by this green inset, all of it banded together by strips of white light from the arc sodiums above. Their shadows were sharp and clear and long, as if thrown by a summer moon. Garrity tipped his canteen up, swigged deep, recapped it, and began to doze again. 80, maybe 84 miles to Augusta. The feel of the wet grass was soothing. He stumbled, almost fell, and came awake with a jerk. Some fool had planted pines on the median strip. He knew it was the state tree, but wasn't that taking it a little far? How could they expect you to walk on the grass when there were... They didn't, of course. Garrity moved over to the left lane, where most of them were walking. Two more half-tracks had rattled onto the turnpike at the Orano entrance to fully cover the 46 walkers now left. They didn't expect you to walk on the grass. Another joke on you, Garrity, old sport. Nothing vital, just another little disappointment. Trivial, really. Just don't dare wish for anything, and don't count on anything. The doors are closing. One by one. They're closing. "They'll drop out tonight," he said. "They'll go like bugs on a wall tonight."
"I wouldn't count on it,"
Collie Parker said, and now he sounded worn and tired, subdued at last.
Why not?
It's like shaking a box of crackers through a sieve, Garrity. The crumbs fall through pretty fast, then the little pieces break up and they go too. But the big crackers...
Parker's grin was a crescent flash of saliva-coated teeth in the darkness.
The whole crackers have to bust off a crumb at a time.
But such a long way to walk. Still.
I still want to live, Parker said roughly. So do you. Don't shit me, Garrity. You and that guy McVries can walk down the road and bullshit the universe and each other. So what? It's all a bunch of phony crap, but it passes the time. But don't shit me. The bottom line is you still want to live. So do most of the others. They'll die slow. They'll die one piece at a time. I may get it, but right now, I feel like I could walk all the way to New Orleans before I fell down on my knees for those wet ends and their kitty car.
Really?
He felt a wave of despair wash over him.
Really?
Yeah, really. Settle down, Garrity. We still got a long way to go.
He strode away, up to where the leather boys, Mike and Joe, were pacing the group. Garrity's head dropped, and he dozed again. His mind began to drift clear of his body, a huge sightless camera full of unexposed film snapping shutter shots of everything and anything, running freely, painlessly, without friction. He thought of his father striding off big in green rubber boots. He thought of Jimmy Owens. He had hit Jimmy with the barrel of his air rifle, and yes, he had meant to, because it had been Jimmy's idea. Taking off their clothes and touching each other had been Jimmy's idea. It had been Jimmy's idea. The gun swinging in a glittering arc, a glittering, purposeful arc. The splash of blood.
I'm sorry, Jim. Oh, geez, you need a Band-Aid.
Across Jimmy's chin, helping him into the house. Jimmy hollering. Hollering. Garrity looked up, half stupefied and a little sweaty in spite of the night chill. Someone had hollered. The guns were centered on a small, nearly portly figure. It looked like Barkovich. They fired in neat unison, and the small, nearly portly figure was thrown across two lanes like a limp laundry sack. The bepimpled moon face was not Barkovich's. To Garrity, the face looked rested. At peace. He found himself wondering if they wouldn't all be better off dead, and shied away from the thought skittishly. But wasn't it true? The thought was inexorable. The pain in his feet would double, perhaps treble, before the end came, and the pain seemed insupportable now. And it was not even pain that was the worst. It was the death, the constant death. The stink of carrion that had settled into his nostrils. The crowd's cheers were a constant background to his thoughts. The sound lulled him. He began to doze again, and this time it was the image of Jan that came. For a while, he had forgotten all about her. In a way, he thought disjointedly, it was better to doze than to sleep. The pain in his feet and his legs seemed to belong to someone else, to whom he was tethered only loosely, and with just a little effort he could regulate his thoughts, put them to work for him. He built her image slowly in his mind. Her small feet. Her sturdy but completely feminine legs. Small calves swelling to full earthy peasant thighs. Her waist was small. Her breasts, full and proud. The intelligent rounded planes on her face. Her long blonde hair. Whore's hair, he thought it, for some reason. Once he had told her that. It had simply slipped out and he thought she would be angry, but she had not replied at all. He thought she had been secretly pleased.
It was the steady, reluctant contraction in his bowels that raised him this time. He had to grit his teeth to keep walking at speed until the sensation had passed. The fluorescent dial on his watch said it was almost 1 o'clock.
Oh God, please don't make me have to take a crap in front of all these people. Please, God, I'll give you half of everything I get if I win. Only please constipate me. Please, please,
His bowels contracted again, strongly and hurtfully, perhaps affirming the fact that he was still essentially healthy in spite of the pounding his body had taken. He forced himself to go on until he had passed out of the merciless glare of the nearest overhead. He nervously unbuckled his belt, paused, then grimacing, shoved his pants down with one hand held protectively across his genitals, and squatted. His knees popped explosively. The muscles in his thighs and calves protested screamingly and threatened to knot as they were bullied unwillingly in a new direction.
Warning! Warning, 47!
John! Hey, Johnny, look at that poor bastard over there!
Pointing fingers, half seen and half imagined in the darkness. Flashbulbs popped, and Garrity turned his head away miserably. Nothing could be worse than this. Nothing. He almost fell on his back and managed to prop himself up with one arm. A squealing, girlish voice.
I see it! I see his thing!
Baker passed him without a glance. For a terrifying moment, he thought it was all going to be for nothing anyway. A false alarm. But then it was all right. He was able to take care of business. Then, with a grunting half-sob, he rose to his feet and stumbled into a half-walk, half-run, cinching his pants tight again, leaving part of him behind to steam in the dark, eyed avidly by 1,000 people.
Bottle it! Put it on your mantle! The shit of a man with his life laid straight out in the line! This is it, Betty. I told you we had something special in the game room. Right up here, over the stereo. He was shot 20 minutes later.
He caught up with McVries and walked beside him, head down.
Tough? McVries asked. There was unmistakable admiration in his voice.
Real tough, Garrity said, and let out a shivery, loosening sigh. I knew I forgot something.
What?
I left my toilet paper home.
McVries cackled.
As my old granny used to say, if you ain't got a cob, then just let your hips slide a little freer.
Garrity burst out laughing. A clear, hearty laugh with no hysteria in it. He felt lighter, looser. No matter how things turned out, he wouldn't have to go through that again.
Well, you made it, Baker said, falling in step.
Jesus,
Garrity said, surprised.
Why don't all you guys just send me a get-well card or something?
It's no fun with all those people staring at you, Baker said soberly. Listen, I just heard something. I don't know if I believe it. I don't know if I even want to believe it.
What is it? Garrity asked.
Joe and Mike, the leather jacket guys everybody thought was queer for each other? They're Hopis. I think that was what Scram was trying to tell us before, and we weren't getting him. But, see, what I hear is that they're brothers.
Garrity's jaw dropped.
I walked up and took a good look at them,
Baker was going on.
And I'll be goddamned if they don't look like brothers.
That's twisted, McVries said angrily. That's fucking twisted. Their folks ought to be squatted for allowing something like that.
You ever know any Indians? Baker asked quietly.
Not unless they came from Passaic, McVries said. He still sounded angry.
There's a Seminole reservation down home across the state line, Baker said. They're funny people. They don't think of things like responsibility the same way we do. They're proud and poor. I guess those things are the same for the Hopis as they are for the Seminoles. And they know how to die.
None of that makes it right, McVree said.
They come from New Mexico, Baker said.
It's an abortion, McVree said with finality, and Garrity tended to agree.
Talk flagged all up and down the line, partially because of the noise from the crowd, but more, Garrity suspected, because of the very monotony of the turnpike itself. The hills were long and gradual, barely seeming like hills. Walkers dozed, snorted fitfully, and seemed to pull their belts tighter and resign themselves to a long, barely understood bitterness ahead. The little clots of society dissolved into threes, twos, solitary islands. The crowd knew no fatigue. They cheered steadily with one hoarse voice. They waved unreadable placards. Garrity's name was shouted with monotonous frequency, but blocks of out-of-staters cheered briefly for Barkovich, Pearson, Wyman. Other names blipped past and were gone with the speeding velocity of snow across a television screen. Firecrackers popped and spluttered in strings. Someone threw a burning road flare into the cold sky, and the crowd scattered, screaming, as it pinwheeled down to hiss its glaring purple light into the dirt of a gravel shoulder beyond the breakdown lane. There were other crowd standouts. A man with an electric bullhorn who alternately praised Garrity and advertised his own candidacy to represent the 2nd District. A woman with a big crow in a small cage, which she hugged jealously to her giant bosom. A human pyramid made out of college boys in University of New Hampshire sweatshirts. A hollow-cheeked man with no teeth in an Uncle Sam suit, wearing a sign which said, "We gave away the Panama Canal to the communist niggers." But otherwise, the crowd seemed as dull and bland as the turnpike itself. Garrity dozed on fitfully, and the visions in his head were alternately of love and horror. In one of the dreams, a low and droning voice asked over and over again, "Are you experienced? Are you experienced? Are you experienced?" And he could not tell if it was the voice of Stebbins or of the Major. Chapter 12. Somehow it had got around to 9 in the morning again. Ray Garrity turned his canteen over his head, leaning back until his neck popped. It had only just warmed up enough so you could no longer see your breath, and the water was frigid, driving back the constant drowsiness a little. He looked his traveling companions over. McVries had a heavy scrub of beard now, as black as his hair. Collie Parker looked haggard, but tougher than ever. Baker seemed almost ethereal. Scram was not so flushed, but he was coughing steadily, a deep, thundering cough that reminded Garrity of himself long ago. He had had pneumonia when he was 5. The night had passed in a dream sequence of odd names on the reflectorized overhead signs. Veezy, Banger, Herman, Jampton, Winterport. The soldiers had made only 2 kills, and Garrity was beginning to accept the truth of Parker's cracker analogy. And now bright daylight had come again. The little protective groups had reformed, walkers joking about beards, but not about feet, never about feet. Garrity had felt several small blisters break on his right heel during the night, but the soft, absorbent sock had buffered the raw flesh somewhat. Now they had just passed a sign that read, "Augusta, 48, Portland, 117.
"It's further than you said," Pearson told him reproachfully.
He was horribly haggard,
his hair hanging lifelessly about his cheeks. "I'm not a walking road map," Garrity said.
"Still, it's your state."
"Tough."
"Yeah, I suppose so."
There was no rancor in Pearson's tired voice.
"Boy, I'd never do this again in 100,000 years.
You should live so long.